Welcome to Food Matters Live. This is the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're putting the Mediterranean diet in the spotlight. It's considered to be one of the healthiest diets in the world, but do we really understand what it is? And in any case, can you separate the food from a place and culture and still retain any of its benefits? Well, it's cropped up again and again on this podcast. When we talked about COVID and nutrition, there it was. When we talked about the gut microbiome, there it was. When we interviewed Tim Spector about genetics and personalised nutrition, there it was again. And when we talked about nutrition and age, yeah, you guessed it, there it was. It's hugely influential. So today we're going to dive deep into the Mediterranean. We'll find out what the diet is, what evidence there is that it's good for you, and we'll look at the science behind it. Our expert guide is Dr. Simon Poole, medical doctor and author of two relevant books, The Olive Oil Diet and The Real Mediterranean Diet. In 2019, he was awarded Fellowship of the British Medical Association, and I am delighted to have him here. Simon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a real privilege to be here.
It's fantastic of you to spare your time for us. Now, maybe we should start with the basics to make sure that we're really clear on what we're talking about. What is a Mediterranean diet? What does it look like? What does it taste like?
So the Mediterranean diet is a very ancient diet, which actually stretches back millennia. And it's also more than one diet because there are many regional variations of the Mediterranean diet.
It's a big place, the Mediterranean, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are different influences in different countries of the Mediterranean. So North Africa, for example, will have different herbs and spices, different cultural identity with the Mediterranean diet from, let's say, Spain or Italy. But the themes that run through are that it's based essentially on whole grains, on plenty of rich, colourful vegetables, lots of herbs and spices, legumes, beans as a great source of protein, with some fish, not universally in the Mediterranean, but in general towards the coast, fish and poultry, and really very little by way of processed foods, very little added sugar other than very natural raw honey and very few sweetened desserts, and much less red meat is consumed. So it's a really healthy, traditional, slightly varied and quite nuanced and subtle diet across the Mediterranean that, as I say, has evolved over many millennia. In fact, foods have been introduced to it from the New World. Tomatoes we see as an integral part now of the Mediterranean diet. But of course, they're a relatively recent addition in comparison with the herbs and spices that came across the spice route many, many hundreds of years ago.
Now, I mean, apart from the red meat bits, the you know, a bit of beef and a bit of lamb, I would have said that's pretty much sort of my diet, really. You know, and I'd say it's a basic British diet. As I say, a bit more red meat. I'd make my own salami, so a bit of processed meat there as well. But do you think there's been a lot of froth out there, a bit of media froth about the concept of the diet, a bit of half-baked nutritional advice, maybe a bit of pseudoscience thrown in?
Well, I think the problem often is that the Mediterranean diet is just thrown in as an expression, as if we all know exactly what it is, as if we're all familiar with the principles of it, which actually confer the healthy aspects of the diet. And actually, it's often added to other people's unique diets and say, oh, well, when you're eating this particular food, you know, just eat a Mediterranean style diet. And in fact, actually, it really takes a deeper dive to understand some of the real elements to it, which confer health, the anti-inflammatory elements, the antioxidant elements, like polyphenols, the food combination, what happens to foods when they combine together, some of the effects on insulin sensitivity, some of the effects on the glycemic index, glycemic load of the food. Actually, when you drill it down, you can identify certain aspects of the Mediterranean diet, which unless you're really getting into your diet, you may well not be benefiting from some of those more nuanced aspects of the diet. And of course, Stefan, you may be having quite a Mediterranean style diet, but as we know, many people out there are having diets which are very high in unprocessed foods, very high in high glycemic index carbohydrates rather than the whole grains that we have with the Mediterranean. And, you know, if you look at bean consumption, for example, in the UK, and I don't mean the beans you get in a can with tomato sauce. I don't mean the baked beans. I mean the breadth of legumes. We're really not seeing that. And then also you need to look at quantities. So, for example, in the traditional Greek diet, 750 grams of vegetables would be consumed a day, whereas we in the West tend to consume only about 250 grams. And then olive oil as well, extra virgin olive oil, 30 to 50 mils in the traditional Mediterranean diet equates to about 12 litres per person per year, and we're consuming about a litre per person per year. So there's a sort of tenfold increase in extra virgin olive oil that perhaps we need to really get the benefits of that in the Mediterranean diet.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of sort of media reporting and people's sort of own definition of their personal definition of, oh, I'm eating Mediterranean tonight, something like that. What are the most common things that people get wrong? Is it about specifics or is it about the completeness of the diet?
I think it's both. I think there are issues with the specifics. So, for example, if I ask a patient of mine how well they're adhering to the Mediterranean diet, they'll say, well, I have a very Mediterranean-style diet because I have vegetables and I have fruit and I have olive oil, but I'm not really sure what the difference is between extra virgin olive oil. And, of course, I'm not sure I should cook with it or not. And then nuts, perhaps, and pomegranates. Mm. And so people kind of find it actually difficult often to really describe that whole diet, but they might believe that they're having a natural and healthy diet, which may be good for them, but not really getting the turbocharge that we know exists with some of those ingredients in the Mediterranean diet, following the principles. In particular, for example, cooking with extra virgin olive oil, which we may come on to later, but that's a really integral part, and a relatively small part of our cooking in the UK is based around extra virgin olive oil used as a predominant cooking ingredient.
Yeah. And the sort of, as you mentioned, the concept of the Mediterranean diet is thrown, bandied around quite a bit. But let's look a little bit about the specifics. What solid evidence is there that the diet benefits our health? Any examples of benefits that really stand up to scrutiny?
So, yes, I mean, there have been lots of very large studies now which have shown the Mediterranean diet to be beneficial. And I could name the studies, the EPIC study, the nurses study in the USA, and most importantly, probably the PREDIMED study. And that was a study that really got scientists sitting up in their chairs and really excited, because, of course, nutritional science, as you know, is quite challenging. It's often observational, and unless you have really very large numbers of participants, it's often difficult to draw conclusions. And of course, the gold standard trial is a randomized controlled trial. And as far as possible, the PREDIMED achieved that by dividing up people into the Mediterranean diet and a standard Western diet and moving forward, looking at the evidence. And so the nature of that PREDIMED trial, which was first published in 2013, but there's more rich evidence coming from it, is really showing extraordinary benefits. For example, a 68% relative reduction in risk of breast cancer for those people adhering to the PREDIMED Mediterranean diet, 30% reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, of stroke. And in fact, the trial had to be stopped prematurely because after 7 years, the evidence was so compelling in the Mediterranean diet group that it was felt unethical to continue without informing those people who weren't on the Mediterranean diet that really they should be. So the evidence is very robust. And now we're beginning to see that also demonstrated for some individual ingredients. And so, for example, extra virgin olive oil, which we constantly do keep coming back to in the Mediterranean diet because it is such a fundamental part of the diet, extra virgin olive oil itself as a single ingredient seems to be conferring measurable benefits and identifiable benefits in scientific studies with regards to, for example, reduced risk of heart disease and so on.
And just to be very clear and to be questioning as much as we possibly can, are there any negative effects of adopting the Mediterranean diet?
So there don't seem to be any negative effects. There certainly doesn't seem to be a point at which a more Mediterranean diet becomes in any way harmful. I mean, clearly you can eat too much of anything, not least because it might upset your GI system. But there really doesn't seem to be any disadvantage. And we know that other traditional diets that have been studied and vegetarian diets to some degree also show health benefits, which are aligned with those of the Mediterranean diet. Now, clearly, if one was to take one ingredient and almost exclusively feed on that, that ingredient and believe that that is the superfood of the Mediterranean diet, then there might be a problem with that. But the Mediterranean diet as a whole, traditional, natural diet over many millennia, which I think humankind has evolved to eat over the years in this healthy way.
Mm. And can you transpose a diet from a place? I mean, the Mediterranean climate is very different. There's possibly a different sense of community, exercise, family ties, all these other things. Is it possible to exclude those factors from the Mediterranean diet as a concept and still find medical benefits?
Absolutely. And many people say to me, of course, oh, well, life in the Mediterranean is so lovely because everybody sits around swimming pools and eats lasagna. So they're bound to be much more healthy. But of course, we know the reality of that is not true. But on the other hand, clearly a replete level of vitamin D from a little bit of sunshine, a sense of community, difficult to measure. But again, there seem to be some studies which show in particular zones of the world where there is a sense of community, perhaps religious unity, that does seem to confer some health benefits. The siesta itself has been shown, again, to possibly confer some health benefits. But you can take all of those potentially what we call confounding factors out, and you can just take the diet and you can apply it to different populations in other parts of the world and study and demonstrate that those benefits are experienced there. There's a fascinating study based in Harvard where they're taking firefighters, the American heroes from actually from Chicago, and they're training firefighters in cooking and adhering to the Mediterranean diet, and they notoriously can have quite poor diets, and they're showing benefits to their health, measurable benefits around markers of cardiovascular disease, around biomarkers of inflammation, and so on. So it absolutely can be transferred and transported to other climates and other populations, it seems.
And then in terms of the details, things like the patterns of diet and the way that the diet is consumed, having three decent meals a day, no snacking, eating late in the day, which is important in some areas of the Mediterranean, but not all. Certainly the French don't like eating late in the day. You try and get anything done at midday around France, ain't nothing happening. Are these also important? Can you compound the effects of a Mediterranean diet by adding these slightly more cultural issues?
So again, if we look at the science, because we have to stay strictly with the science rather than what might necessarily just be intuitively true, it is true, it has been shown that if you eat in company and if you value food, you tend to eat more slowly. So you tend to consume fewer calories if you are engaging in a communal experience with food rather than a TV dinner sitting by yourself consuming food. The studies which show that you tend to consume less and you tend to consume more healthily when you eat in that way. Timing of meals, I think there's insufficient evidence to say whether or not it's best to eat earlier or late, but spreading meals out through the day. Actually, snacking is not completely unacceptable. There are some Mediterranean cultures where they do have a tradition of snacking. But of course, instead of snacking on what we might snack on in the West, crisps and sugar-laden sweets, it tends to be olives, nuts, seeds, dates, things that, again, follow the principles of being whole grain carbs or healthy fats, rich in antioxidants and anti-inflammatory polyphenols, perhaps, and so on. So it depends on what you snack on as much as any piece of fruit. Those kind of things can be very much part of a Mediterranean scene, really.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the firefighters in Chicago seeing big benefits from the diet, but does it affect everyone universally? Is there a difference in the demographic, in body type, in age, in terms of how much benefit you can get from the Mediterranean diet?
So this is a very interesting question. Nutritional studies tend to, in order to demonstrate benefit, they by definition have to be done over large populations with many participants in the study. And so one gets a sort of macroscopic view where you say, well, if we take, as they did in the PREDIMED study, 7,000 patients and put them in this group, 7,000 subjects and put them in another group, we're going to get some discernible, some statistical differences. Now, if you were to look at that in more detail, you might well find that there are subgroups of that population who benefited more or less from it. But those kind of detailed levels of study haven't been undertaken. What is interesting, though, is that some of the benefits at least may be from really important compounds that probably the most important thing that we eat that we've never heard of, which are polyphenols. Polyphenols occur in plant-based vegetables and fruits. They're often colored. They sometimes taste a little bit bitter because they're part of the plant's defenses, but they have quite profound antioxidant and anti-inflammatory levels. And we do know that people's response to those tends to vary. And so people might be quite sensitive to the antioxidants in dark chocolate, for example, but other people with other genetic profiles may handle those differently. And indeed, we all have relatively unique gut microbiomes, and how those antioxidant, anti-inflammatory polyphenols interface with our gut microbes is difficult to tell on an individual basis. But if you look at populations, there's no doubt they are having an effect. So I guess the answer is there's more research, as always, that's needed. But in general, for populations, adopting that kind of diet is very likely to be healthy for most of us.
Yeah. So you mentioned polyphenols. Let's dive into a little bit of the chemistry. Can we taste polyphenols? You said that sometimes they're associated with bitter foods. What are they likely to be in highest concentrations?
Yeah, so I think polyphenols, absolutely fascinating area. Polyphenols are compounds which are produced by plants really for their own defense. And so it's defense against the stresses of the reactive oxygen in the environment. So against oxidation with ultraviolet light and with oxygen causing breakdown. I mean, we only have to look at an apple, which has got a rich polyphenol layer of skin. If you cut it open, if you expose it to oxygen, it will very quickly start to change color. So these are compounds which have antioxidant effects, and they're produced by the plants in defense from their environment. But they also often produce them to defend themselves from being eaten. So by passing herbivores, they sometimes have a quite a bitter taste, which is something that we humans have and can learn to enjoy. So often the most concentrated levels of these antioxidant, anti-inflammatory polyphenols tend to occur in, for example, herbs and spices. Again, often in the outer layers of plants, because they are designed as a plant defense. But we can taste them in the bitterness and the pungency of chilies or of herbs and spices. And interestingly, one of the most studied group of polyphenols is in extra virgin olive oil. And now we know that the most healthy extra virgin olive oils we can actually taste, because they are the ones that give us a little bitterness and some pungency, as opposed to a sort of flat, tense taste profile. And not only are plants very smart in terms of producing these compounds for defense, but if the environment becomes more stressful, they increase these levels of polyphenols. So, for example, if you have a tree that's slightly stressed, an olive tree that's slightly stressed in its harsh environment, and it's not over-irrigated, it's not given an easy life, not mass-produced, then it will tend to produce very high polyphenol, quite bitter and pungent, but really delicious when mixed with food, extra virgin olive oil, which we know is particularly healthy because there have been studies which have shown that these polyphenols, although they go through a mysterious process of the gut microbiome and at a cellular level, we don't understand that completely, but we do know that they reduce the oxidation of LDL cholesterol. So they reduce the inflammation of our cholesterol in arteries, which is one of the main contributors to heart disease. So it's kind of stories that link the biology, the fascinating stuff that plants do, the really smart things that plants do, with the taste and with the effect on health. And it's extraordinary that we can see this, and we can actually look for particularly colored vegetables. We can perhaps taste them, and we can perhaps understand and recognize that this will have a larger number of these fascinating polyphenol antioxidant compounds.
And you mentioned the anti-inflammatory effect of the Mediterranean diet. Can you tell us a little bit more about what do you mean by that, and in what way does this particular diet help?
Yeah, so this is really important because we're now beginning to understand that not only do the majority of chronic illnesses depend on lifestyle factors, but also the majority of chronic diseases actually depend on chronic inflammation to drive those diseases. So that whilst we used to think of heart disease as gradually the blockage of our arteries through furring of the walls through cholesterol, we now actually know that it's the inflammation of the cholesterol plaques that actually drives heart disease and is likely to end up giving us a heart clot. So inflammation is really important, potentially also in the development of cancers and other conditions. So inflammation is key to many chronic diseases. And we can look at diets and we can see elements, and polyphenols are an example of some of the compounds which decrease inflammation. And you can feed somebody on a very poor quality diet, really very low in vegetables, very low in these polyphenol colored bitter vegetable compounds, and you can feed them a poor quality, high in processed foods, high in sugar, and you'll see that they have greater markers of inflammation. And there was one really interesting study which is being repeated now, because originally it was on a small group of people, which I call the sofrito story. And this is a really fascinating experiment because we measure bioactive markers, as we call them, of inflammation. So if I see a patient in my practice who has arthritis or another inflammatory condition, I might measure their C-reactive protein or their interleukin levels to measure the level of inflammation that they've got going on with their arthritis. So we can measure inflammation. And these scientists took a group of people and fed them a very poor diet for 2 or 3 days, which had very low levels of anti-inflammatory compounds, what they thought were anti-inflammatory compounds, and measured their CRP and their interleukin, these measures of inflammation. They were in the normal range, but they were sitting, on average, quite high in that normal range after this diet. Then they fed them a single meal of sofrito, which is a delicious meal of tomatoes, of onions, of extra virgin olive oil, and of garlic, which is commonly consumed, often for breakfast, actually, in the Mediterranean. They fed them that, and then 2 or 3 hours later, they measured these bioactive markers, these markers of inflammation, and showed that they were considerably and measurably reduced just after that one meal, which is quite extraordinary because it makes one wonder if each meal, each food, each time one's sitting down to a meal, one is influencing the inflammation, that these low levels of inflammation that are going on throughout the day as we live. And I think that's really exciting because it actually means that what we eat now can influence our levels of inflammation potentially through the day. And so it's a very real, I think, a measurable phenomenon. And if you look at the Mediterranean diet, you can put it on a scale, on a dietary inflammatory scale, dietary inflammatory index, as it's called. And the Mediterranean diet ranks extremely highly on that because it's got foods that we know have these anti-inflammatory effects.
And how clear is the benefit? I mean, could we say that that parts of the Mediterranean diet can control arthritis, or is that a step too far?
So if we have particularly genetic drivers of disease, which are really powerful, then clearly people will develop illnesses and disease, notwithstanding that we know that 70% or so of chronic diseases can be very significantly influenced by lifestyle. But there will be people who have arthritis, which is very driven. The factors are not completely known, maybe some genetic influence and so on. If we feed the Mediterranean diet, there have been studies which show that people's pain levels and people's levels of inflammation with arthritis, specifically in this context, can be reduced. So people will report small-scale studies, nothing that we can completely hang our hat and coat on and say, absolutely, this is, and certainly nothing that we can say that can at the moment replace medications. But we know that diet can help and support people with these kind of chronic conditions. Yeah. And certainly for conditions like heart disease and stroke, which are often highly influenced by lifestyle factors, we know that we can see 30% relative reduction in risk, for example, with the Mediterranean diet. So these effects are really quite significant. And even with an ingredient like extra virgin olive oil, an association, so it's difficult to say that it's causal, but an association between 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil a day and a reduced risk of heart disease by 44%, came out of the EPIC study a few years ago. So an observation, an association, but really potentially quite significant and important.
And you mentioned a little bit about the gut microbiome. Do we know much about the interaction between the med diet, or certainly ingredients within it, and the microbiome? Obviously, hugely complex area, lots of research still unfolding. But any conclusions that we can draw yet?
Yeah, and I think the headlines from that, and you're absolutely right, there are many specialists really fascinated in this, and I would defer to them for expert advice. But the headlines, I think, so far are that a diverse and healthy gut microbiome clearly has an effect on our health, not just physical health, but also potentially mental health. And so to have a diverse and healthy gut microbiome, with particular gut microbes which we know are positive, beneficially for health, is clearly important. And the Mediterranean diet has been associated with an increased occurrence of this diversity and of these particular bacteria which are considered to be healthy. And of course, another thing is that a diverse diet, a highly plant-based diet, a colorful diet, one that challenges our microbiome, has also been shown to be beneficial. And again, the Mediterranean diet ticks that boxes as being a very varied diet, in terms of, particularly in terms of the variation in fruit and vegetables. So we're just beginning to learn and understand, but it seems like everything else, the Mediterranean diet, as you said in your introduction, really, it seems to pop up everywhere. And when we ask about the gut microbiome, certainly the Mediterranean diet seems to be associated with a healthy and diverse gut microbiome by virtue of the ingredients that are within it.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the important thing really here is implementation and convincing people to shift their diet towards a Mediterranean diet. You know, food is both our world and our work, and so we'll eat pretty well. But obviously it's harder to implement it in people who may not be as engaged with their food, or have food poverty. There are issues with actually getting hold of ingredients, possibly knowledge to cook them, and certainly time, because a lot of people, you know, the poorer we get, the harder pressed we are to find time to cook properly. How do we spread the word, and how do we make it easier for people to eat better?
I think that's a really fundamental question. Clearly, it's a compelling question, because the rates of obesity, the rates of type 2 diabetes are increasing year on year. So clearly it's really important to do something to actually improve people's diets. I think the first key is education. I think people do respond to a greater understanding, and that's really where I am at. I started off supporting and helping my patients here in Cambridge to adopt a more Mediterranean diet, and though it's anecdotal, I saw many, many people coming back and feeling much better. And in terms of continuing on the diet, there doesn't seem to be a problem with that, because it's such a delicious diet. And you
it's
know,
an easy sell, isn't it?
Exactly. And as long as people understand it, and I think, as I said really at the beginning of the interview, it is about fully understanding and engaging with it, and understanding some of the more subtle nuances about food combinations, about cooking with extra virgin olive oil, and how that distributes the polyphenols and even creates new polyphenols and new antioxidants. So it's about people understanding, and I think there's a lot of science, but actually it's about translating that into a way that people can understand. And I hope that I do that through my speaking engagements and through my books. And then, of course, there is an issue about affordability. And, of course, extra virgin olive oil is not a cheap product. I mean, the reason why it's not a cheap product is because you can't mass produce it. You can't produce it on an industrial scale, insofar as it's a tree which varies in terms of its production overall. You know, each year we'll have a different yield and so on. And it has to be harvested carefully and without oxygen and so on. So it is a relatively expensive product. But I think that part of that education is to at least help and support people to value food more. So if you look at the proportion of our spend on food, when I think 70% of people play the national lottery, and 74% of people have access to cable television, for which there's a monthly subscription. You know, whilst I completely acknowledge that there is food poverty out there, which I think, you know, needs to be tackled clearly through different methods, but I think there also is an element of choice and education as well, so that people can actually make those informed choices, perhaps to maybe value food a little bit more. And sometimes I think we go to the supermarket perhaps each week and come away thinking, oh, this is great. I've spent £10 less than I spent last month or last week or whatever. Whereas actually that may not be the right attitude to have. Maybe we should be saying, well, you know, this is great that I'm investing in really good quality food, which I know will benefit my health. And so I think it's about shifting that value, and also about cooking and helping people to prepare foods. And again, that's about education, because it has been shown, there was a study in New Jersey, that they took a group of individuals who did have food poverty, and they gave them a Mediterranean diet, but they actually taught them to cook. And if you scratch cook, and notwithstanding the time clearly that is involved in that, although sometimes I think that's overplayed, to be honest. I think you can create something actually much more quickly. You don't have to do a fancy recipe from a book to create a relatively quick and easy scratch food. But actually, it was shown to be cheaper, in fact, than buying heavily processed foods. So I think there's something to be said by that. And there's also something about government having a role to actually also increase the affordability of fruit and vegetables, at least in a way that they have not done so far. So I think there's a political issue around that. So education, I think cooking from scratch, I think potentially even taxation in order to support and help people to adopt this much healthier lifestyle.
Mm. Okay, my last question then really is, I mean, we've been talking about the Mediterranean diet for many years. It's been around. It's been reported in the papers, and yet I think you're right that there's not a depth of understanding of it. Are there any surprises and secrets about the Mediterranean diet that you think people are not aware of? Is there, or possibly an easy starting point within which to start going down the route of eating a Mediterranean diet? What do you really wish people knew that you think that they don't?
So I think there are several elements to that. I think the first thing is that actually if people value taste and slightly different tastes, so the sort of slight bitterness and slight pungency of herbs and spices and other ingredients and the sulfur compounds in garlic, for example, all can be associated with health benefits. And so I think that if people value those to taste in food and to actually understand the link that has with health, I think that's really important. I think there are other aspects which I think people sometimes almost fall off their chair in surprise at. So, for example, we worry about carbohydrates and we worry about the glycemic rise, the rise in release of sugars, understandably because we have an increase in type 2 diabetes and obesity, much of which is driven by high glycemic index carbohydrates. So the one way to reduce the glycemic load of a meal is to add some extra virgin olive oil to it, because as a fact, it suppresses and slows the absorption. So when you think about it, when you go to Italy, you have pasta, they drizzle extra virgin olive oil on it. When you go to the Middle East, you have a flatbread, you always have extra virgin olive oil on it. And you know, it's fascinating because we can see that undoubtedly reduces the sugar rise and can actually increase insulin sensitivity. So it's about these food combinations, which I think are fascinating. And another secret is, for example, that one of the concerns we have about cooking red meat is the formation of compounds called heterocyclic amines, which are potentially cancer-causing. So classically, the barbecued, blackened barbecued meat we might have, that taste to it as well, is potentially because of these heterocyclic amines. Well, if you marinate meat and if you cook meat in marinade of extra virgin olive oil, herbs, spices, red wine, and garlic, I think was the combination used in one particular study that comes to mind, you can reduce the formation of heterocyclic amines by as much as 70%. So isn't it extraordinary how, you know, again, in the Mediterranean, you would be inclined when you did have red meat on those feast days and festivals, it would be heavily marinated, it would be combined with all these protective compounds. It might even be cooked in the extra virgin olive oil itself. And then one final secret along those lines is that not only does it actually help prevent the production of these potentially cancer-causing compounds in meat, but also if you fry fish, then the very heat-sensitive omega-3s, the polyunsaturated fats in fish, which are very heat-sensitive, tend to break down as it's fried. But again, it's been shown that if you cook with extra virgin olive oil, the extra virgin olive oil, which has a higher smoke point and absolutely tolerant to all known cooking temperatures that we have. So let's be clear, extra virgin olive oil, I mean, the Mediterranean diet simply wouldn't work if it was not safe to cook with extra virgin olive oil. So extra virgin olive oil has been shown to wrap itself around the fish oils, the fish omega-3 oils, and actually preserve and protect those omega-3s so that when we consume our fish fried gently in extra virgin olive oil, we will benefit from those omega-3s. So I think, you know, it's been said, I think, that we know more about what goes on in the middle of a comet than we do that goes on in the middle of our souffle as we cook it. Not that souffle is a particularly good example of the Mediterranean diet necessarily, but it is true that these food combinations and what happens in cooking is an extraordinary element, which I think is becoming of increasing interest, and particularly in the interactions in the cooking within the Mediterranean diet.
Excellent. Well, I think you've done an amazing job of spreading the word as well. So, Dr. Simon Poole, thank you so much for joining me today.
That was my pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, if you go to the site and search Nutrition and Age, you'll find the episode where we explore the link between what we eat and our health in later life. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.